having our Sunday school class, but surprise, it's going to be a different class. We're not doing our prayer series today. We will not resume that next week either. This week we are going to, and we won't resume it the week after. This week, well, we'll resume it the week after that. This week I'm going to give a report on General Assembly. So I know I just mentioned vacation, but before that I was really working when I wasn't here the first week. Actually, rather long days. They make you stay up till like 9 o'clock in session, basically, every day. So I'll be talking about General Assembly, kind of giving a report about the denomination and different things that went on and the work that was before the Assembly. So that's this week. Next week, we have a very special speaker coming. His name is Daniel Mahowski. You might remember about a year ago, we had Daniel do a Sunday school lesson. And Daniel's hoping to eventually make it to seminary. And so part of our, you know, nurturing future leaders is to be able to give them opportunities to practice gifts. And so he's going to come and teach on adoption, which if you remember, when he taught a year ago, he taught on justification out of the catechism. And the next question is about adoption in the catechism. And eventually we'll have him come back and do the one after that, which is on sanctification. So that's next week. The week after that is the barbecue week, which we don't have Sunday school on the barbecue week, but that means we all still come to help set up for the barbecue. So that means then the following week we'll resume our prayer series. Though I heard you did get a little bit of prayer series last week. Pastor Stark said, what are you guys going through on Sunday school? I mentioned the prayer series, and so he showed me a number of his lessons on prayer and said, which one do you think would be good as a complement to what you guys did? So hopefully you found the one we chose last week to be helpful in the prayer series. So today, General Assembly. Anybody know where General Assembly was held?
Chicago,
that's right. Chicago, Illinois. Technically, it was Palos Heights, Illinois, and it was at Trinity Christian College. Anybody ever heard of Trinity Christian College? Not too many people, but a few. It's a historically, as far as I understand, kind of established by the Dutch Christian Reformed folks in America. And if you remember, Grand Rapids isn't that far, where there's an awful lot of Dutch Christian Reformed. And so here in the greater Chicago area, they had this nice Christian college established there. So it's a nice facility. I did, by the way, just as a side note, make sure I don't forget, I did get to stop in at Chicago Lagunitas. That's their second place. And I did get to have some Chicago deep dish pizza when I was out there. Last day, right before we made it to the airport, I got my deep dish pizza. Anyways, I wanted to, but our last judicial case went on and on and on and on. And I'm looking at the time. We're not going to make the game. I'm looking at the time. I didn't buy the tickets, but there was a chance if we finished early, we'd be able to have a chance to go to the game on Monday night, and we did not finish. We did finish early, but we finished like Monday, like 10 o'clock or something like that. So they kept us later to finish on Monday instead of going through on Tuesday. The way the schedule works, it's Tuesday evening to the following Tuesday at noon. We ended up finishing early by staying a little later on Monday night, so we kind of had the morning off on Tuesday before we had to travel out of town. Other presbyters from our presbytery that went, there was myself, there was the Berkeley pastor, one of the, Wayne Faulkner, one of the Berkeley elders, John Rodifer, there was the Battle Mountain pastor, Alan Dueck, and there was the Monterey Bay pastor, Joel Robbins, and one other elder, Mike Ziegler, from our Roseville, Sacramento congregation. So that was our team from our presbytery. And the very first thing they do at these general assemblies is they pick a moderator. And last couple times I went to, there's always a vote, right? There's always a few different candidates, and they finally vote and pick one. This time they opened the floor for nomination, and it was silent. It was like crickets. Like nobody's being nominated. And finally, Larry Westerveld, he's a pastor from Hatboro, Pennsylvania, was nominated. And since there was nobody else nominated, then he got the job. And usually these things are all coordinated ahead of time. You kind of know you're going to get nominated, right? So when he gets up there, he says, I hope you like my suit coat. because it's the only one I've got. You know, he wasn't expecting to be moderator. The moderators usually wear suits. Maybe not everyone else wears suits. So he had the same suit coat on all week, but we forgave him. Though he did tell us that the official story that he's going to go home and tell his wife is that it was a large contentious vote, but he won by a landslide. So anyways, I digress. So one thing that we did a little bit different at this General Assembly is that the very first session was started with a worship service where we had communion. Now, I guess that was a more historical practice, but over time, probably because of the busyness of the assembly, they opened up with just a devotional instead of a full-on worship service with communion. But they changed that, and I think in part because the moderator from the last General Assembly is the one who always starts the new one and usually gives a message. Well, he's a ruling elder, so I'm guessing he probably didn't want to preach a sermon, so he said, why don't we go back to the old practice, and they had a pastor preach, and they did communion. It was a very nice way to open up the service. We said it would be nice to do more of that stuff on Presbytery. Maybe it would be a way to remind us in the midst of busyness and business and sometimes heated discussions and conflicts in the midst of our business, and to be able to remind ourselves of that fellowship we have even as we come together before the Lord's table and the preaching of the Word. So in addition, by the way, to starting in that worship service, every day during the assembly there were devotions in the morning, a little mini sermon given. Throughout the day there are songs and prayer offered. Every single report, you get a prayer afterward. Every single break or start of a break, you get a song at the beginning of the new session. And so I mention that to say, you know, it's not all just work. We get chances for prayer and for worship together. On the Sunday morning, kind of along the same lines about worship, there were several local churches that the men all went to, and we got to go to one. Now I'm forgetting the name of the city, but the pastor was Matt Cotta, and he was a Westminster West grad that Wayne Faulkner knew, so we said, we'll go to his friend's church there, an OPC church out there. So that was Sunday morning, and they fed us a nice, huge potluck, big spread. You might remember we did the same thing a few years ago when GA came here. We had several men over, and you might also remember that one of the men who came on that time was Larry Westerveld, who is the guy who became moderator this last time. So we had the moderator at our church a few years back. So that was very, very great. And then Sunday evening, back on the college campus, they had a whole sort of all the local churches, big gathering worship service in their big church hall there. So there were several churches and all the commissioners for General Assembly all there, one big worship service. I must say, the organ that they have at this place, it's not only humongous, but had these big, like, trumpet pipes sticking out of it, too. It was loud. A couple days ago, the night before is when a few of us were able to go to Lagunitas, Chicago. And you go into Lagunitas, Chicago, and it was so loud there, like, you couldn't even talk, couldn't hear yourself think. We had a nice time going there. We're kind of happy to get out of that noise. And then we come the next day to Sunday, we're like, we're back at Lagunitas, I think. It's so loud. They were doing like the prelude, you know, with the organ. Anyways, that's all just sort of the worship components. I wanted to give you a sense of some of the stuff we did worship-wise. As for the business, give you an update on a number of various things. One of the questions I get sometimes is with regard to worldwide outreach. How do we do on our budgets in terms of the money that's come in? You know, we do a thank offering every year, and there's also offering, you know, that churches give throughout the year to worldwide outreach. By the way, who remembers the three committees that make up the worldwide outreach of the OPC? Judy?
Home missions.
Foreign missions.
Christian education,
yeah. At some point, I don't know when, they realized there was a bit of, you know, difficulty for churches in terms of trying to support the main ministry of the denomination, which really are those three main things. You know, do you send money to the home missionaries so that you get more churches planted? Or do you send money to the foreign missions to do more foreign missions? Or we got this support ministry of Christian Ed. Where do we send the money? And trying to figure out who to send what to. So they decided at some point, let's encapsulate those into one area of giving. You give to worldwide outreach, and then the denomination decides who needs which money. And so about 10% of it, I think, goes to Christian Ed, and I think the rest is split half and half, approximately, maybe a little bit more to foreign missions for church planting and foreign missions work. So I thought it was helpful to hear that the budget for last year, I think, was around $3.5 million, and we took in around just under $3 million. So it was a little bit lower than normal. Typically, we tend to make our budget on that. And they've kind of got some things built into place. If they see the numbers aren't quite getting there, then they can cut expenses a little bit, which they did. Their expenses were roughly around $3 million. So they, even though they didn't quite hit their budget, they didn't exceed it in terms of going over budget. For next year, they're planning a 2%, approximately 2% planned growth on their budget for worldwide outreach, so sort of a minor increase. But overall, we'll talk more about worldwide outreach in a moment, but overall, financially, it seems the denomination is doing well enough and have reserves, so that was good to hear. Some of the stats about, you know, they gave a number of stats on the denomination as a whole. One thing I thought was interesting, the growth this last year was basically about flat. So in other words, we're slightly under. So in terms of the number of members in the overall Orthodox Presbyterian Church, which is a little bit of a deviation from the last probably 10 years. Last 10 years or so, we've had, you know, maybe around 2.5% growth every year in terms of members, which isn't huge. But this one will happen to be more of a flat year in that regard. And I think I read 2.3% is the average growth since the beginning of the denomination. Every year, average 2.3% growth. So that's not super high, but we're thankful for the growth. So yes, Mary. I'm sure people do. I remember one General Assembly, there was the PCA fraternal delegate there, and you know, they're like 10 times the size of us, but they're also really close to us in terms of doctrine and history, and you know, we have the same roots. And I think that year we grew like a half of percent that year, and then the fraternal delegate got up and said, because sometimes there's this impression that the PCA, you know, being so much bigger is more progressive and therefore maybe not as, you know, more cared about church growth than Reformed theology. That's kind of sometimes the negative stereotype that's put on them. And the guy got up there and said, you know, well, if it means anything to you, we only had, I think, 1% growth. So he was trying to say that whatever that impression may be, our growth is similar. He was saying the PCA's growth is not much different than the OPC's growth from year to year. But when you start much, you know, they started about 10 times the size of us to begin with. So they're continuing about that same size, but just, you know, growing at a similar rate. Now, I don't know how that compares to the other similar Reformed denominations, or how it compares to just completely evangelical denominations, I don't know. I do know that when I first got here, talking to the Presbyterian Church in town, the PCUSA, now we're talking, you know, very different denomination, they said they have been averaging around a 5% contraction every year. Now, I don't know if that's still the case, but at least at that time it was. Daniel?
The PCUSA lost 6% last year.
Well, there you go. Now, that is not surprising, because part of that loss, I'm sure, is they have churches just pulling out of the mainline because of liberalism. That, you know, it was liberal theology back, you know, in the 30s when we left. It's gotten far, far worse. And so they've got new denominations that get formed every few years, essentially, and are the latest exodus from the PCUSA. So, yeah. Good questions. In terms of home missions, they reported on various new church plants. They started 5 new works, new church plants. Again, when I talk church plants, we're talking about largely in basically U.S. and a little bit in Canada, but mainly U.S. These are church plants within our presbyteries. And 5 were started this last year, including one in Corona. You guys know where Corona is? Southern California?
Yeah.
You said within our presbytery. You mean within our denomination?
Within presbyteries, within our presbyteries, is what I said. Meaning the difference between foreign missions would be ones that would be outside the bounds of our presbyteries.
Yeah.
And the home missions are church plants within the bounds of our existing presbyteries.
Sorry if I didn't enunciate there.
So one in Corona, California, which is Presbytery Southern California. And they also are starting a new one this year in Pasadena, California. So I thought that was interesting. I didn't mention the other ones because I figured you may not know those other areas, but Pasadena and Corona hopefully are ones that you know about area-wise. The pastor that we went to church with on Sunday when we were there, the guy who went to Westminster and knew Wayne Faulkner, he's actually the pastor that's leaving there to go plant the church in Pasadena. So I thought that was kind of interesting. He's only there for a few more weeks and then heading out to Pasadena. So, another thing that the Home Missions Committee reported on was some of their strategy with regard to Canada. Right now, we've got a few churches in Canada that are in the Quebec area, and they're part of the Presbytery of Michigan/Ontario. Maybe that means that they're part of the Ontario province, I guess. I don't know the geography very well. But we also have one Canadian church that's on the other end over in British Columbia, and that's part of the Presbytery of the Northwest. And so there was discussions about further expansions into Canada and what's our long-term goal there. And what they ended up deciding is that that church in that's part of the Presbytery of Northwest is going to leave that presbytery and join the Presbytery of Michigan and Ontario, so all the Canadian churches are part of one presbytery. It's a long distance, but the goal is, as you may have noticed elsewhere, when we go to, say, Uruguay or Uganda, we're not trying to start OPC extension in Uruguay. We're trying to start a Reformed denomination in Uruguay and a Reformed denomination in Uganda. They decided a long time ago that logistically it would be really hard to have a denomination that was worldwide, meaning, you know, how are you supposed to, you know, get together with General Assembly with other countries that have different languages, that type of thing. So the goal of moving these Canadian churches into one presbytery is that eventually we're going to remove them all together and start essentially either a Canadian presbytery or a Canadian denomination. And the Canadian presbytery would just be a start toward a Canadian denomination. So it would be like OPC Canada, and they would be organizationally distinct from the OPC and the U.S. of A. So, Daniel.
I guess now I have two questions. Was the church planted in Georgia mentioned?
And they may have. I don't recall. Sorry.
Okay. In terms of the I see the Presbytery of Canada working out. I know that RPCNA actually has a Presbytery in Japan. And granted, there's only like 4 or 5 churches over there in Japan, but they still manage to make it work.
Well, not so much at this meeting in the sense that that's been discussed in the past. And the strategy of the OPC for years in the past now and continuing moving forward has been to not go that route. That was the route they could have gone in a number of different places because we have 4 mission fields all over. And at some point, I don't know who all was involved in the decision, presumably General Assembly ultimately, but the OPC's model has been to not go that route, but to just to plant indigenous Reformed denominations per on a country basis, largely speaking. Jim?
If they were to form the OPC of Canada and a tragic situation happens, like they go south on their theology, does our OPC have the ability to say, look, we need to drop our name if they go south on doctrine?
I don't know if they would actually use our name when they establish themselves. Yeah.
You understand my question.
Absolutely, yeah. That's kind of a hard to answer question. The answer would be no, but whether they actually use our name, we don't know. Yeah. And maybe by point of reference, CRC Canada is the denomination like Neil's from.
Yes.
Is not in any way tied organizationally to CRC in U.S. CRC in the U.S., we do not have fraternal relations with anymore. We do have fraternal relations with CRC Canada, even though they're completely different denominations, even though they sound similar. Judy, did I see him? I think you're right. Yeah, I think that's called the Orthodox British Church in Uganda. And I don't know details about them, but...
Was it started by missionaries?
I believe so, yeah. Whether they'll do that in Canada, though, I can't say. I would imagine they probably would, but I don't know. I think we're a few years away from that, too. good. Foreign missions. Let me... see if I can pause my recording. Other foreign missions is that we had a little retirement ceremony for Brian and Dorothy Wingard. Who knows who Brian and Dorothy Wingard is? Anyone? Anyone?
I've seen them in obviously the magazines.
Yeah, so they were on the Uganda mission field, which is not a sensitive mission field, which is why I turned this back on here. Plus, they're retired anyways. They're not going back out. So, Uganda mission field from 1994 to 2016. So we've been in Uganda and doing an awful lot over the years. And so these were some of the really key family in all the Uganda work. And so they had a little retirement ceremony and kind of acknowledged them. They came up and prayed for them. And then we had... hors d'oeuvres afterwards. There's a little party they threw, so it was nice. Okay, good. That's foreign missions. Tell you a little bit about Christian education. One of the big discussions that came up is there's been talk for a while about wanting to put together the shorter catechism in non-Elizabethan English, you know, get rid of the these and the thous and all that kind of stuff. And... they were going to call it the modern English version, and the point would be it would just be an extra tool. It wouldn't be our standards. It would just be something that could be used in classes. That was given to the Christian Ed Committee, I believe, last year to work on. They came back this year and said, we didn't work on it. They said, instead, we want to go and take a step further. They want us to think about doing... a few limited language updates, not as something separate, but something that would actually change our doctrinal standards, where Westminster Confession, larger and shorter catechism, be updated in two ways, morphological and archaic words. So morphological means hath would be has, doth would be do or did, I guess. Archaic words. Who knows what a stew is? Look it up at home. I won't say it in company here. it's not a good place to go. It's a violation of the seventh commandment to go to a stew. Let's just say that. So they presented a report of like all the different ways you could update language, like seven different main categories. And they said, we just want to do these two, which we think are the most narrowest updates. And the bottom line is they didn't ultimately make a decision. They kind of kicked it back for another year. They said, we want to give it back to the Christian Ed Committee and think about some of these different things and report again. Because you got the impression that Christian Ed Committee decided this kind of late in the game and didn't have all the questions answered in terms of how much funding they needed for the, you know, a number of different practical aspects. So I suspect this will still be a project in the future. But it is at this point kind of tabled for a year to do some more research on it. Jim?
There's already a very good one out there that has updated the language and the text views. It's updated the Confession of Lord Jesus Christ Catechism with the ESV supporting verses that's outstanding. They are out there.
I suspect. If we go this route, I'm certain if we go this route that they will consult resources such as that. That was one of the questions. If they go this route, what about the Ten Commandments? The Ten Commandments are currently quoting the King James, which have the doths and the haths and stuff like that. And so would we just update the morphological endings there? That might seem a little strange. To change the King James text, would we leave it for sort of historic value, or would we change it to a different version, like the ESV, for example. So those are some of the questions that weren't addressed. Either way, just as a heads up, this is a long-term process. So if they come back next year and say, yeah, we want to do it, what they'll probably means is that they'll have a committee to work on this. The committee will come back then the following year, present what they think should be the changes. They'll get a lot of feedback and have to come back the next year showing all the changes were implemented. And then it can be voted on by that General Assembly. Because it's a constitutional change, it would then have to go to all the presbyteries, kind of like amending the Constitution of the United States, how you'd send it out to the states to ratify. It's like Congress would vote on it, but then the states have to ratify it. Well, that's the way it would work here. General Assembly would vote for it, and if they voted for it, then it would go to the presbyteries, and I think you need like two-thirds or three-fourths, I forget the number of presbyteries to ratify it. And then it goes back to another General Assembly, and they have to do a final confirmation vote, and only then does it change our Constitution. Other things are not that hard to do in the OPC, but changing our Constitution is hard to do, and it's intentional, right? We don't want to just willy-nilly change our doctrinal standards. So, Daniel.
I understand why it would take a while. That's good. I don't understand why that's considered a change of doctrinal statement when you're just updating the language.
So that's the argument here is that, look, we shouldn't sweat too much about this in the sense of getting this work started because we're not talking about substantive changes. The concern by maybe people who would be resistant on this is, okay, you tell us right now you're not going to do substantive changes, but like, you know, the word stews. You probably pick the word brothel, and that'll work. But other words maybe, the words you pick that's newer might have a subtle little difference, you know, in terms of the nuance of that word. And so I think morphological is less of a concern than archaic. And then even then, which words are archaic? And so that's a judgment call to some degree. And so if they come back with the most conservative amount of changes, therefore the least likely that they'll have substance changes, then I imagine this won't be too challenging for the assembly to adopt. You will also still have people who have the perspective of this is our historical document. We don't mess with it. It's a picture of history. And so some people, one person said, like, you know, we don't go and update the Declaration of Independence. But the response was given, but the Declaration of Independence is a historical document. We don't, in every generation, redeclare the Declaration of Independence, right? But our confession is a sort of ongoing, still in a force and effect doctrine statement. And, you know, we want our kids who we want to learn this to know what the words mean. If we've updated our Bible versions, how come we haven't updated our doctrinal standards into something that, you know, especially the lay people will be able to take in without having to go and learn Elizabethan English? So, yeah. You know, and I think the argument there is they had to do it because it was in German. And they had to put it in English anyway, so we might as well put it in modern English. So, Jim.
Historically speaking, we have made changes to our 1788, 1903, 1936. There have been not only stylistic changes, but theological changes in our confession. So that argument really isn't sound.
And the interesting thing is, if this happens, it'll be probably the largest change in terms of the number of things touched, but the smallest change in terms of any substance. You know, changing it from executeth to executes isn't a doctrine change, but it is a word change. So, and there's a lot of those. I know, because me and the kids, you know, are going through these. Anyways. Okay. Other questions on that? So that was the Christian Ed update. Other update on the Christian Ed front is on the Psalter hymnal. So right now, of course, we use the Trinity hymnal. This is the second main hymnal used in the denomination. Second main one, I mean, before this, there was Trinity hymnal edition 1, was in a blue cover. Then eventually they updated it to Trinity hymnal new, which is a red cover. very confusing then to people when we put the blue covers on because, you know, we use the blue edition. No, we actually use the red edition. So we have been working on a new hymnal called a Psalter hymnal. One of the desires has been to have more psalms, actually all psalms, in our hymnal. Right now, if you look in our hymnal, there are a decent bit of psalms, but there's not nearly all 150. And so the Psalter hymnal, the first half will be Psalter, will be psalms, at least one psalm for every, at least one song for every psalm. Some of them will have a few different ones. And put in a more easier to sing tunes. You know, a lot of these old psalters, the tunes have been rather archaic at this point and not the easiest to sing, which is part of the value of this new Psalter hymnal. The other half will be a hymnal and have all the wonderful great hymns that we're used to singing. So what was really cool about this is that when we started in this process, we asked if other denominations would like to get in on the project. And the United Reformed Churches, our URC brethren, they said, we want to be involved in this too. And so this has been become a joint project between the OPC and our sister denomination, the URC, who, as Daniel was just mentioning, their doctrinal standards are the three forms of unity, the Belgic Confession of Faith, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Canons of Dort. And so in the back, they'll also have all these Reformed confessions. They'll have the three forms of unity and our own Westminster standards, which, if you connect the dots, became a question mark. If we're going to update our Westminster standards, are we going to delay the printing of the Psalter hymnal to wait till that gets done? That's years in the process. They said, no, we're not having this conversation. Already they've wanted to have these Psalter hymnals already done by now. They should have, according to the original timetable, already be sitting here. But they got delayed in the process of getting all the copyright approvals. Some of the tunes and some of the texts, you have to get essentially a negotiation for use of these in your hymnals. And so that process is taking longer than what they would have wanted, but it's getting close to being done. They're hoping later this year they'll begin taking orders and start printing either by the end of the year or right in the beginning of next year. They're offering discounts for people who pre-order, so we'll have more info on that when it comes. Jim?
Any idea of any expense?
No. I know that the discount is going to be $3 off of volume, but I don't know how much the actual cost will be. I don't know. I don't know. They didn't say this either. Part of the process was taking out some of the unused hymns. Unused. So there are 750 or so in here that not all, you know, there's a lot. You do enough talking to people and you find consistently that hymn number, whatever, it doesn't get used really very often at all anymore. So that will fall out, making room for the Psalter portion. So related to this effort, next General Assembly is going to be held, I forget the technical word with it, but simultaneously with the URC. When I say simultaneously, we'll be in one room, they'll be in one room, and we'll be having our General Assemblies together at the same time, and there will be opportunities to get all together and have like big worship services, that type of thing. And this is to express this wonderful act of ecumenicity among two denominations that are so like-minded and have gone in on this project together. By then, surely the hymnals will be ready, and they can use them. Well, yeah, they better be. I'm saying next year they got this joint meeting between the two. They better be ready by then. So that was one of the arguments when they said about should we wait to print these things. He said, oh, but the URC is expecting these. You know, we got to get to print. So, a couple other announcements. So one of the things that was a long time in working is you guys might remember the Bible Presbyterian Church. That was from our church history class on American Presbyterian Church History. 1 year after the OPC started, a number of people left and formed the Bible Presbyterian Church over some doctrinal issues. And when I say that, at the time it seemed like we all left the mainline because of liberalism, but when we all then got in our own room, we realized you've got some that are very Presbyterian, others who are just more evangelical and weren't liberal, and those guys left and formed the Bible Presbyterian Church. And there's been essentially a rift that's gone on over this, over all this. So a number of years in the making has been healing toward that denomination, and they've really been reforming a lot. We talk about Semper Reformandum. They've really been rediscovering their Presbyterian roots, along with a number of their churches leaving because of that. And so the denomination of the Bible Presbyterian Church is very small now. I want to say like 27 churches, like a tenth of the OPC. At any rate, because of all the growth that they've gone on, the OPC and dialogue that's been going on for years, the OPC, this General Assembly voted to extend fraternal relations with the Bible Presbyterian Church, like we have with the URC, the PCA, these other Reformed denominations. What that'll mean practically is more pulpit swaps, you know, where you might have a Bible Presbyterian pastor fill the pulpit, or you might have stuff on the mission field where we both send missionaries to one particular location and work together. Jim?
And the 27 remaining Bible Presbyterian churches have become more reformed.
So
there were issues when they left that they held on to that would distinguish us from them.
Their doctrinal standards are the Westminster standards. They do have an update in there with regard to pre-mill eschatology, not dispensational, but pre-mill eschatology. The guy who came and spoke was very adamant that they love the Westminster Standards, and that's kind of the rift that started in their denomination of those who were really committed to the Westminster Standards and who weren't. One of the issues was regarding alcohol, and they said, we wholeheartedly affirm the chapter on liberty of conscience in that regard. Though I think in culture and practice, most all maybe of their pastors are not drinkers. So he made a joke. There was a big deal about the campus at Trinity Christian College that you'd get a $500 fine if you had any alcohol at all on campus. And they gave us this little handout showing us you'd get a $500 fine. And so the Bible Presbyterian pastor, he got up there to extend greetings, you know, like they do. And he's like, I really appreciate all the efforts you guys took to welcome us here this year. And he held this up. I thought it was pretty funny. So yeah, they do have a culture in general of that. But my understanding is from a doctrinal standpoint, they're wanting to say, you do have the freedom. We're just in practice generally not going to do that. So. Well, again, the Westminster Standards, when they updated, they never updated the stuff on the covenant. It was always covenant theology was all left in there. So if you take an actual poll of every single Bible Presbyterian pastor, I can't speak if there are any with dispensational leanings on there, but it would be my understanding that, yeah, therefore they would be more historic pre-mill, not dispensational pre-mill. So. I would imagine that I would be shocked if they weren't. My understanding is they had a pretty big split a few years ago where the dispensationalists basically left. And I don't know all the details of that, but that was the sad or good part about that. It was sparked because of these dialogues with the OPC that essentially broke denomination into two. over sort of the conversations that came out of it, and who are we, and are we Presbyterian, are we something else? So we're out of time. Just a couple little quick little side notes. OPC pension, the whole program has been revolutionized in the last year. I was not in it before. I am in it now. I'm very thankful for it. It's a good new program. And one last thing to mention, before caring for ministers, essentially retired ministers or ministers with financial needs, would be covered by one of two committees, either the Diaconal Committee or the Pensions Committee. Because of a lot of overlap, they're taking those duties away. The Pension Committee essentially goes away, and the Diaconal Committee's duties all merge into a new committee called the Committee on Ministerial Care. And so, for example, the Obadiah Fund will now be managed by that committee and other areas of caring for ministers and retired ministers and retired ministers' wives. That's all going to be covered by this new committee. I was actually part of the advisory committee that dealt with all of that, so I was able to get in there and learn more about that in great detail, which was exciting. So always more I could say. We're well out of time. I took you 5 minutes late. Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for our denomination and its work. Bless us now in this break. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.